From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 65, recorded Saturday, May 19th, 2007. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. Support is also provided by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Martin Fowler and David Hainemeyer Hansen at the Rails Conference in Portland.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. We're here in Portland, Oregon, my hometown, at the Rails Conference at the Oregon Convention Center. And I am sitting in a little area here off the side of the exhibit hall. If you hear some background noise, that's because the exhibit is bouncing here at Rails Conference. And I am sitting with David Hainemeyer Hansen and Martin Fowler. How are you guys doing?
Doing great.
Yeah, just cool.
All right, that is the extent of the wasting of time. We shall commence. Yesterday at the booth here, at the ThoughtWorks booth, we had kind of an interesting conversation and turned into a bit of a mud wrestling match, and I thought we had a pretty good time. It's too bad we didn't tape that, but David, I had brought up the issue that I thought maybe HTML had seen its day. Like, I'm tired of pushing angle brackets around that are really using ineffective small constructs, and you didn't agree.
No, I don't. I very much enjoy the current standards we have for creating applications. I think the low level of expressiveness that we have in HTML and CSS and JavaScript is actually a huge bone to most applications. That constraints are a good thing. That constraints leads to better applications when we don't need to reinvent everything. When you just have a blank canvas where you can paint whatever you want on it, you pretty much end up with something quote-unquote original every time, and I don't think originality in UI design is necessarily a good thing. I just think, actually, most of the time it's a bad thing. And more importantly, in the terms of HTML and CSS for the developer, I think those are great tools. I do not want to go back to the desktop world, and I actually kind of resent that notion that HTML and CSS and JavaScript are dirty technologies. From the perspective of desktop developers who've been used to a more cleaner development experience somehow, but I don't think clean translates to pleasant in that sense.
Are you using clean and dirty within, are you using that to describe the developer experience or the underlying stuff that is being abstracted away? Because the desktop's just as messy as the web.
Well, what I'm seeing is that people conflate those two issues. They see HTML and CSS as dirty languages or implementations because there are bugs in different browsers and so on, and then they kind of bleed that into development experience. Because HTML or JavaScript has issues in various browsers, that should also mean that the development process itself is dirty. I think that that's not really true. I think the HTML and CSS style development is actually incredibly friendly and clean to the developer. It's a really easy way to get applications going because you don't have all the options of the world. You don't have a blank canvas that you can paint anything on. So you have to use the pure, simple building blocks that are available. And once you take that creativity out of it, things just become a lot simpler. There's not so much confusion about what to do. There's a lot of conventions in HTML on how to build information applications,
right,
which means that you don't have to think about all that stuff over and over and over again, which is, in essence, the same argument we have for Rails. Why are conventions a good thing? Because you don't have to make the same decisions again and again.
Well, you're saying that the universal building blocks, to draw a weak analogy, the quarks that we have discovered so far are adequate. But there's always the talk that there might be something else out there. Is there life beyond checkboxes and radio buttons? Is there an input type equals that we haven't discovered yet that is going to make the molecules that we build from all of this fundamentally more compelling?
And I think that's great. And it's called research. And I don't think we should conflate research with day-to-day development. And I think, first of all, like, we've already had that blank canvas for 10 years on the web with applets, with Flash, with a bunch of other technologies that gave us a blank canvas where we could dream up anything we wanted. Did we get better input models? No. We just have 10 years of history showing us that someday we might end up on that great breakthrough, but it hasn't happened yet, so I'm not going to hold my breath waiting for Silverlight or Apollo to deliver that. If it happens, and if this great breakthrough does happen, it's wonderful. I'm not going to reject that I'm going to stick with HTML for all eternity. I'm just saying we have history of 10 years showing that kind of unsettling innovation has not come out of the blank canvas. So I'm not going to hold my breath, and I'm happy with the tools I use so far.
Martin, you're nodding your head. You agree?
Yeah. I mean, from the early days of web interfaces and the browsers, people have always said, well, this is so inferior to what we can do with a rich client kind of application. And what we've seen is, certainly my sense, is from the user side, people being actually quite comfortable getting used to the HTML. Oh, this application works like a web thing, therefore I know already kind of how to work with it. And also developers finding the whole web model actually working quite well for them. And I'm not in that sense, what my sense has been of it is that people have not been super keen to try and move towards the full desktop experience. There's been occasional flourishes of it, but they haven't really followed through. And so, again, if you're kind of drawing from where we are so far, well, maybe, yeah, there could be some really compelling advantage with some of these technologies, but you know, I'm inclined to bet the way things have gone before and be wrong one time out of 10.
But doesn't it seem like kind of a schizophrenic thing that we've got Beryl in the Linux world doing amazing things with 3D? We've got the OS X, which has been gorgeous for years. And just yesterday, I dropped a dashboard widget onto the background, and this wonderful kind of drop of water effect appeared. We've got Vista doing similar 3D things. Here are, you know, three operating systems on the desktop that really feel strongly that there's some new way of visualization that could provide not just comfort for the user, but presumably some additional functionality. But still, applications like David, like yours at 37 Signals, very clean, crisp, simple, they flourish. Is that kind of split brain, that you're saying that that's okay? People have a mental model for the web and they have a mental model for the desktop.
I think they do, and I think it's interesting. In all the examples you mentioned of interesting effects going on the desktop, I think most of them are just because we can. They're not about adding functionality. Just because you can drop something on the dashboard, it makes a nice ripple effect. I don't think any real users really care. I think geeks go gaga over that because we have this super powerful graphics processor and it's being used greatly in games or simulations or any of these other visualizations or media, and people feel like, shouldn't we also be using it for applications? And they can't come up with anything better than ripples when you drop something on the dashboard. And I don't think that's a representation of good UI design. And I think that's why a lot of the stuff currently going on with Ajax is that people kind of discovered it. Or JavaScript can now actually give us kind of the same things, and they went overboard in a lot of cases. So even just with the limited possibilities we have in something like JavaScript, people already went too far. So I don't think we need even more blank canvas, even more water effects on droplets. I think we need to focus on less things. And I think the great thing about HTML and CSS and the ease of use of just creating basic applications encourages people to just stick with the basics. And I think most people can't handle blank canvases. This is one of the reasons I, traditionally in web applications, have not been a big fan of rich text interfaces. When you give people the tools to make something purple and in Comic Sans, they will put it in purple in Comic Sans. I think MySpace is the perfect example of what happens when you give people all the flexibility in the world. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think we don't even need to look to MySpace. Look at the world of Flash applications. Flash is wonderful for media and enables a bunch of things, but when you actually get down to application design, it's usually horrid.
So what do you think about people that are, I guess you would call them researchers then, that are pushing the limits on how user experience should be it should be expressed. Like we talked about that worrydream.com, the Magic Ink manifesto, where they gave an example of a train scheduling application that used the basic pieces available to us in HTML. It's basically a screen full of checkboxes and combo boxes. And then a more designer-focused, user experience-focused experience that this particular individual said that it's Flash, it's something like that that you're going to need to make that experience reality. You think that's an edge case?
I think that's very much an edge case. And that's the biggest problem I have with the whole blank slate movement is that it's being billed as though we're rebooting the web, as though this is the full new paradigm for application design. And I don't see it as such. I see it as this is the 2-5% case for widgets, not applications. Widgets, there are some widgets, a plane where you want to pick your seat, something where you want to remodel a virtual room in IKEA to see how your furniture aligns. Great. Widgets are awesome for that.
And it's also worth remembering that a lot of what we really need to do is we need to improve the overall interaction experience. And talking about the eye candy and the colors and the icon design is only a part of that picture. I mean, you've got to look much more at the entire interaction that you have with the application. And the ideas of people who are focusing on that level of interaction design, thinking about the entire picture, I think here are people like Jesse James Garrett and his stuff on information architectures. My colleague Jeff Patton has been writing a lot about how to bring user-centered design in an agile context. These, I think, are going to make a much bigger difference because it's going much, much deeper than just the pictures and the eye candy.
And you're saying that the kinds of thought being put around those kind of experiences are going to be able to use the existing tools we have available in HTML, CSS, and they'll be just as compelling?
I think we can get more improvement by focusing on the full picture kind of stuff that they're doing than just splashing a lot more eye candy around. I have no doubt that somebody will at some point come up with an incredibly new visual what's it, and it'll be one of these researchers shooting off and doing the stuff. I mean, 95% of that research is a complete waste of time, but of course we don't know which 5% is the good bit, so we have to encourage the whole 100%. But I think when I'm looking at sort of bang for buck, I would rather be focusing on the people who are looking at the deeper interaction design stuff. I would want to be listening to folks like Jeff Patton or Jesse James Garrett rather than getting familiar with more and more widget toolkits.
So looking at this kind of triangle of individuals here, myself as interviewer, I'm hearing, and tell me if you think this is an incorrect paraphrasing here, but that David, you're concerned about making the developer experience as pleasant and wonderful as possible given the existing interaction elements that we have available to us. And you, sir, Martin, are focused on making the process as pleasant as possible, enabling the people, doing the right kind of research around that kind of stuff, while I'm over here kind of blustering about, but can't there be more? I wish there was more. Star Trek, where's that interface? Why don't I have a touchscreen?
I think they kind of go hand in hand. I think when developers get tools that are blank slates, they get obsessed about them. Like, they direct all their attention and all their focus on making new water ripple effects. And that's time taken away from just core interaction design. When you're restricted in your visual expression tools, you tend to focus on something else. You tend to focus on just, is this something users can use in a more direct fashion? And I think that that's really, we haven't even optimized the HTML application yet. So before you've made that as good as it can be, I don't think we need all these other tools. I think that, like, we gotta learn how to walk before we can run, and we are still crawling when it comes to HTML applications.
Yeah, are we even running in the right direction?
Right, that too.
So, to what ThoughtWorks does, and you guys provide a complete, if I understand correctly, you can provide the complete development experience, you can provide architectural consulting. And you're largely thought of as a thought leader in the process space. Is the development process broken with respect to the user experience? Like, the user experience is not built into the process.
Well, in general, in the world of IT, the development process is broken at just about every axis you might want to look at.
Well, that's why I asked.
Certainly one of those breakages is in the whole user experience side of it, and thinking about how to work with the way in which people are using an application. I think there is a community of people that really try to focus on that. But trying to let that fit with the rest of the development process, particularly the way we like to work, with a very incremental and agile style approach, that is an area that, needs a good bit of work at the moment. And it's an area we've been pushing hard. I mean, we've got a number of people who are in very, very interested in interaction design. One blogger, for instance, what I'd recommend taking a look at is Mark McNeil, who has written some really good stuff about focusing on what exactly it is people need to do. And again, it's concentrating on this entire interaction. What is somebody trying to do? How do we make that simpler for them? And the special effects in the eye candy are, you know, they're kind of cool, but they're less important.
So yesterday we saw at the ThoughtWorks booth kind of a spontaneous demonstration by Ward Cunningham of some interesting visualizations about the user experience. And I thought that we were all kind of impressed by that. And there's some spontaneous applause that kind of happened at the end there. Do you think that this was a visual tool that showed swim lanes a la a UML sequence diagram, except as you hovered over each of the actors, you saw what that what a user would see at that point in the interaction. When I saw that, I said, that's a tool that I don't have. I have nothing like that in my process at all. And Martin is nodding his head furiously here. Do you have something you want to add?
Well, no, other than I mean, this is a typical piece of Ward Cunningham brilliance. I mean, how many times has Ward Cunningham just come up with something that, you know, you look at it and you think, wow, that's way too simple and obvious. And why is it we haven't thought of that for the last 10 years? And that's yet another moment of just Ward knocking my, I mean, I'm used to having my, knocked back by Ward. I mean, if I'm not clobbered by a Ward idea every couple of years, now I'm surprised.
Well, that, when I saw that, it really made me, seeing it, that visceral act of actually witnessing, like, wow, I see where this kind of a tool and this kind of the expression of what that tool is trying to get across could really fit into my development process right now. Because I think that people focus so much on user stories and use cases, and then sometimes the experience, whether it be the experience of a screen or, as Ward was trying to tell us about, the entire interaction, the entire workflow, really gets scribbled on a napkin and then sent off to a designer to make rounded corners.
I think that's a huge point, and I think that's one of the most flawed aspects of modern web application development is the fact that designers are thought of as painters. And those are just people who have to layer something on top of what we already have that's completely reversed of how it should be. So the way we develop stuff at 37 Signals is interface-first development. We do not start on any programming before we have final HTML screens that are ready to be hooked up. And I really think that that's the way it has to be, because even at the level of constraint that HTML gives us, it still matters greatly how the elements are put together. Is this a radio button? Is this a drop-down field? Do you split it into one screen? Do you split it into two screens? How does validations work? All of these decisions happen often off the cuff by programmers, because they're just putting the programming together thinking, well, the designer will make it pretty. And if you think of designers as people who make stuff pretty, that's exactly the path you're going to be let down. And you still wonder, why can't people figure out how to use my application? He made it pretty, it's pink, and it has round corners. And that's just not what designers are supposed to be.
Yeah. I've always used the comic book metaphor where the developer thinks that they're the penciler, and then someone else is going to lay down the ink and the color. But, of course, what they've penciled out is a bunch of crap.
Exactly. And I think that that's just, we need to change that first. So that's why I actually think in parts two why HTML and CSS is so wonderful, because it puts the tool of the design of real screens into the hands of designers. It's not a programming exercise. And even more importantly, if you split those two things up, if you make the construction of the UI so hard that you need programmers to do it, what you'll end up with is designers drawing on cardboards. You'll end up with people working in Photoshop. And we've been there. That was how web design looked from 95 to 99.
And then we slice it up in Dreamweaver and everything's okay.
Exactly. And that's just exactly the wrong way to go about it, because a designer who works in Photoshop works in a different medium than the web. When you can make rounded corners easily in Photoshop, when that's just a function of Photoshop, you will do it. When the designer is forced to work in the natural construct of the web with HTML and CSS, they won't do things that are pushing against the grain of those materials. So it's kind of asking people to make sculptures in clay, and they have to work with steel afterwards. They have to be implemented in steel. That's just not how you get good construction, good art, good anything. You need the people who are making the decisions of how it should work to work as closely as humanly possible with the real materials of the final product.
Now, some people might say that too often prototypes have become actual code, but I'm hearing you say that they're probably writing this, the HTML that becomes the RHTML. They're writing this in static HTML, or they're writing this in Rails? At your company?
The designers and the style we follow is usually there goes one screen. The first screen or the first few screens are done in completely static HTML. But very, very quickly thereafter, we wrap it up, make it dynamic, replace a few things, inject the loop, and then the designers from that point on make all their evolution in the real product. They'll make it inside of the HTML that has sprinkled Ruby across it, and they'll deal with that. And what I'm actually finding is that we have this misconceptions of designers who will scream and run away the first moment they see code, and it's just not true. In a lot of ways, code helps them do their job. Like now there's dynamic, real pieces of data. They don't have to use lorem ipsum to fill it up with crap. And I think that that's another issue we haven't even talked about, the notion of using real data, using a real running application as guiding your development and design process.
And that's a very good segue into thinking about how a design first and a user interface first philosophy fits into a continuous integration process. You know, are the designers are part of the process. They're checking in assets. Their things are building. And now you can certainly break a build when a test is wrong. How do you test if a designer did something incorrect? And is that a spec?
To me, there is no spec. To me, the spec is the interface screens. So we're big believers in saying no to functional specs because there's nothing functional about functional specs. The only functional part is a real running application. So we try to get to real running applications as soon as humanly possible, and then that's the spec. So whatever the way the application works right now is supposed to be the way the application works right now. And if we disagree, we change the real application. We don't go back and try to find some spec and rewrite some of that. Change the real application instead and modify before that.
Yeah, that's a very important thing I want to reiterate, because when David is saying designer first, he's not talking about the way that some people would think that is designer first, which is the designers go off for a couple of months and produce designs for every single web page in the application and then hand it over. We're talking, I'm imagining, so I haven't talked to him about this, that a designer is doing the stuff for the design, the programmer is turning it around, and we're talking a matter of hours or maybe days in the complete turnaround of the application. And that's a very tight iterative process, which I think is very key to this, because you can't imagine what this whole thing looks like. You've got to build it and see it and change it and alter it and make it so that altering the existing application is your normal way of work.
So change happens all the time. You're constantly in flux, but at the same time, we don't ever want to break the application. I was thinking about this in the clean code talk. Robert Martin, Uncle Bob, was saying that you make the tiniest little changes. He kept saying, well, when you rip the guts out of the thing, whether it be designer guts or code guts, you don't want to break it. And I kept thinking while that was happening, well, sometimes you really do have to pull, you can't pull a heart out.
You can do amazing changes if you just figure out how to do it in this small step. The application's always alive. I mean, we look at the Mingle, the project management tool we've been working on. On that tool, I happen to know that, I mean, they have their test base is twice as much as their code base. So two-thirds of the code in that product is tests. And that allows them to do quite violent things. I know that a couple of months ago, they made a very fundamental change for the database schema. I mean, we're talking utterly to the guts of the database schema.
Right, that's the kind of stuff I'm concerned about.
And they did that, and I mean, it wasn't even an event worth talking about. And when they were planning to do it, they were saying, yeah, we've got to fundamentally alter the core tables in this application. Yeah, we'll do that. I mean, it's not a big deal.
And what scaffolding was set up to allow that to succeed? I mean, the people were involved, processes were involved, development environment. There was a set point of health of the overall organization, the overall project that enabled that. If anything was a bit dodgy, it wouldn't have succeeded.
It would be interesting to ask in more detail the team about that. I'm several thousand miles distance, but my sense comes down to it's the way the team works. It's the discipline of the way they work. They're very anal about testing. They're very anal about integration. They're working very closely together. They're making sure the app is always alive, always working, and they figure out how to make these little changes. And of course, the other thing that helps is a very modular application. Rails kind of forces you into a well-designed modular application. That's one of its great strengths. And, you know, these are people who follow through with that.
He just made a very interesting point when he said, which was kind of a throwaway statement, that Rails makes it easy to have a modularized, you know, well-thought-out application. For the ASP.NET developer who probably is listening to this, when they go file new web project, they get a config file, a bin folder where all their DLLs go, and then it's pretty much up to them at that
exactly.
point.
They get a blank slate. And my big issue is against blank slates, because most of the time you don't want to reinvent everything from scratch. There's a huge amount of decisions you don't care about making over and over and over again. I think code structure and organization is one of those things. So Rails doesn't give you a blank slate. It gives you a file cabinet, a full file cabinet where everything kind of has its place from day one. You don't have to invent a new organizational scheme for every project. And the problem is, even though people could reuse these things, most humans are just not that structured. The only way you get that kind of structure is by forcing it in and forcing it upon people. So HTML is forcing people to use the same kind of organization, the same kind of approach to application development by giving them a file folder. There are only these input fields. There are only these core types you can work with. So people do. And they get consistent applications where users can jump from application to application and still know what's going on. Rails does exactly the same thing for code organization, for approaches to development. We give you the file cabinet. So you have to actually make the choice to throw that file cabinet out if you want to start from scratch. And nobody wants to do that. So you goad people into doing the right things by making it harder to do the wrong things. So it's not that Rails gives you the opportunity of having better organization. It's really makes it almost impossible not to have that. You have to make an active statement to get bad organization.
Yeah, you want to add something, Martin?
Yeah, I want to follow up. That was one of the things I really liked about Rails. So I don't know how many times I've started a new project in a new environment and think, okay, where shall I put my source files? Where shall I put this? And Rails just does it for you. You just hit the button and away it goes. And there is an equivalent in the .NET world, Tree Surgeon, which a colleague of ours wrote with Mike Roberts. And it does a similar kind of thing. But the point with Rails is that it's really deeply in the psyche of every Rails development project. It's very hard to go against that grain.
That is true. In the .NET world, you do spend a lot of time kind of setting up your desktop, you know, rearranging icons. I kind of think, you know, get your make file set up, make sure that even the notion of development versus test versus production, these things are not necessarily baked in. Now, you had said something interesting, David, when you said that you kind of goad people into doing the right thing. And I wanted to talk to you guys about this kind of sense of, you guys have seemed to have successfully used peer pressure to make people write better code. I mean, the community has a sense of beauty. I still haven't been able to put my finger on it about what beautiful Ruby code is, at least that Americans write. And you had commented that Japanese people write very different Ruby code, and it has a different sense of beauty.
They do, and that's actually interesting. So beauty is very much a cultural term, and it's very culturally relative. So one community will think something is beautiful, and another community will think something else is beautiful. And I've kind of just seen that split looking at some Japanese Ruby code, where I think, huh, that's interesting. That's a very different approach than we take in a lot of the Rails code, for example. Doesn't mean that one thing is better or worse than another. It just means that it actually strengthens your sense of aesthetic when you can identify different branches of beauty. And we have a particular branch of beauty in Rails code, and we have a particular branch of thought on how you should organize your projects. And the thing is, it's not just peer pressure. It's actual code. It's actual structures. So the peer pressure comes in terms of when you generate a new model, you cannot choose not to have a test for that model. It's simply not an option for the generator. It will generate a test file for you. So it's that peer pressure comes in form of the fundamental structures we have in the Rails setup. You don't get to choose testing from. You don't get a lot of these things are just not options. We have opinions about these things. So it's not to say you can't avoid it. You certainly can. But if you're just following the flow, if you're just getting into Rails, if you just want to learn and know what's going on, you'll just run the default commands and you'll see what's going on. Huh, they generated test files for me. I guess that means I should be testing. And that just flows people into good manners without forcing them. So it's not peer pressure in the please have a smoke or take a line of coke. It's peer pressure in the sense of, like, why shouldn't I do this? I get something back that's good for me. And I'm new here. I'll do as they do in Rome.
Huh. So within the Rails community, there's this correctness, there's a sense of beauty, the sense of smell kind of came with the environment. So that a newbie, even a few months into it, starts to have a sense of what's right and what's wrong when he sees something that's potentially outside the norm, he knows as well. I remember when I worked at Nike 10 years ago doing Java, and we had, sometimes we got so wrapped up in OO for OO's sake, we kind of forgot about the big picture. I've noticed in the .NET world, a lot of people are doing that a little bit with interfaces. They're just thinking everything in the world can be solved with an interface and a provider and a pluggable model. I've been trying to get my head around that where is our communal sense of code smell and how does that fit into, how can I use that in the development process? It's interesting that even things like naming, it's baked into the system.
I think name is a huge thing. I think it's one of the most important skills you can have in programming is being good at picking great names. And I think by the fact that we force you to call something X, that we have pluralization, for example, which I think to most people, if they had heard the idea up front, they would think it
would
be crazy.
Well, explain that. Explain that to the listener. They may not know what that is.
So pluralization in Rails works in the sense that models are singular. So you have class person. And now the place where these people go to sleep, what is that called? It's called the people table. So we pluralize pretty much anything to do that conversion. You have person goes to people, you have goat goes to goats, projects to projects.
How do you turn? You have a table somewhere, a dictionary?
We actually reverse engineered the English language pluralization scheme to a fairly high degree. We have something like 95% hit rate on that, and pretty much 100% on the common words that people use, task and projects and all of these. We actually had a very interesting debate at one point on how to pluralize octopus. We actually have that now. There's a special rule just for octopus
so
and
if
octopi.
If I have an octopus
model
I will
look
get
for an octopi table. So that's the kind of the level of, it just got fun. It got fun in the way that we care about these things so much. And people say, wouldn't it be easier if you just had person and person? There wouldn't be any translation. There wouldn't be this big scheme for pluralization. But no, really, we made a point that we prefer those aesthetics. I prefer the aesthetic of pluralization. My collections are plural, so my tables should be plural too. So we went through all this effort just to make a point about aesthetics matter.
Well, you decided to care about a particular thing.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think this is something as well that's come from the way the Ruby community has grown up, particularly in the U.S., where the people who went into Ruby early on were people who did care about this kind of thing. I mean, not just David, but also, you know, the Prags have always cared a great deal about writing code is writing to. Is
the
one
pragmatic
of the
programmers you're
referring
to. The
pragmatic programmer book. What we've seen is the people that got into Ruby tended to be people who cared a lot about the design, about the expressiveness. It attracted like-minded people, and that generated the kernel of that whole community around that degree of caring about that stuff, and I think we're reaping the benefit of that at the moment.
I think actually in large ways we had a huge fuss at one point in the Rails community about pluralization, people saying this is crazy, this is the worst feature about Rails, and in some ways they're true from a technical perspective that it doesn't really make sense, but it was kind of a firewall. It was a firewall for aesthetics. So if you could not appreciate why we did this, why we chose to go through all of this work to get prettier code, maybe you weren't yet in a state of mind that was a good fit for this community. So we try to weed people out in some sense. If they don't share the same cultural bias, if they don't share the same values, then maybe they're not a good fit for the Rails community. And we try to put those decisions very upfront, so you don't have to get 6 months into Ruby on Rails to realize, hey, maybe I don't share the cultural values. We have the cultural values on the door of the entry. So you're not going to walk into this house if you don't somewhat respect these values or can learn to appreciate them.
Yeah, the passion definitely seems to be built in. I mean, this is my first Rails conference in Portland here, and it is a very passionate crowd. It doesn't appear to be any everyone has an opinion here.
Well, again, look at the origins of the community. I mean, what made .NET popular? Microsoft told you this is going to be the next big thing. What made Java popular? IBM and Sun told you this is going to be the next big thing. What made Ruby popular? There was no corporation backing it.
I would say that it was using Seth Godin's idea virus idea that there was a vacuum out there of pain, and the pain was the lack of beauty and lack of comfort for the developer, and that vacuum sucked in a large amount of people.
But it was very much a grassroots thing. I mean, the closest thing you got to big corporates is Thoughtworks, and we're only 800 people, for goodness sake. I mean, there isn't that in the Ruby community. That will change. Those pressures will come in. But like in software development, a big system depends a lot on those early iterations that set the tone for how the rest of the system will be built. My hope is that what we're doing with Ruby, the early days are going to create such a kernel around Ruby and Rails that will, as it grow, help set the tone for a community that will continue to follow the kinds of things that David's talking about.
Now, thinking about the growing of this nascent community and thinking about the size difference that you just, the kind of a juxtaposition between Microsoft and ThoughtWorks, as Microsoft brings things to bear like this dynamic language runtime, is it possible for someone as big as Microsoft, 40,000 people now? I'm not sure. They're big. To get involved in such a way that people would actually respect some of the things that they would offer?
I think most technical communities respect real contributions of any kind. And that's really where it rests on. For the Ruby and Rails community in general, there's definitely a bias against Microsoft because there's a long history. There's a long history of events and actions that company took that was not appreciated, let's say it mildly like that, by the open source community in general and the Ruby on Rails community in particular. That doesn't mean it can't change. For example, Sun forced Java upon a lot of people, and Ruby and Rails is a rebellion in some sense against that kind of culture, but doesn't mean we don't appreciate JRuby, for example. Sun has stepped up and paid people to work on furthering a compiler, a runtime for Ruby that's not the default C one. You don't see anyone batting that. I mean, that's a good thing because they stepped up, did a real contribution, and then they earned some respect. So that's usually how you do it. Microsoft definitely has to work harder for that. They have a much, much higher mountain to climb in that sense of regaining some respect from this community, but nothing is impossible.
There's definitely a sense of a significant inflection point coming up at the moment. A large part of it is the growth of dynamic languages in general, Ruby in particular, and a sense of we can really change the way in which we think about corporate IT. And we want to get rid of the bloatware and the stuff that's out there. What I've seen from Sun is a really great willingness to engage with that. And the whole JRuby enterprise, hiring some of the leading JRuby developers and letting them do the job, the decision to absolutely implement Ruby the way it is so that you can take a C Ruby application, complex one like Rails applications, and run them on JRuby, that was exactly the right thing to do. Now the question, and that has been answered by Sun, kind of for the Java community, interestingly by Sun, not by IBM. Now the question shifts back to Microsoft. Will they do the same thing for the CLR? Microsoft has done many things over the last couple of years that shows an openness to deal with what I think is the reality of the open source movement. Instead of trying to deny it and push it back, they've begun to open up a little bit. And if that trend continues, we could well see a good Ruby implementation on the CLR. On the other hand, we have the 235 patents fiasco. And if that's the attitude of Microsoft, then the mountain has just got a lot bigger. And the point is the future is developers. And I know that there is concern in places in Microsoft that they've lost the attention of the alpha developers, and that's in the medium long term is going to kill them. And I think their reaction to open source in general, their reaction to Ruby in particular, that's going to make a big difference for Microsoft's future.
The characterization of the alpha developer and that it was in the medium and long term, it's almost has a kind of an insidious quality to it. It's like there's a bit of a diaspora happening, it seems, and people, the alpha developers, the alpha dog at the company is missing something, that sense of beauty that we talked about before. And if Microsoft doesn't join the conversation in some substantive way, they might wake up the next day and find that guy's not there anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we at ThoughtWorks, we got heavily into .NET, decided to get heavily into .NET when .NET came out. It was a big deal at ThoughtWorks. You know, we have a lot of geeks and developers. Microsoft not terribly popular. We were solidly in Java. It was quite a risk to get involved in .NET, but we did, and we've done quite a lot of .NET projects. What we've noticed very recently is, particularly in the US, a notable falling off in .NET project starting. Now, we don't know whether this is just, it's fairly recent. We don't know whether this is a blip or a trend. But we're noticing it and thinking, people who come to ThoughtWorks tend to want to be pushing the edge. That tells us that maybe people don't think .NET's the edge anymore. Java's going along perfectly fine. It's steady. Ruby is a huge surge. I mean, we've announced 40% of our new business this year is Ruby.
Wasn't there the sense that Java has plateaued over the last 2-3 years?
I think so, yes, for us. But the intriguing thing is .NET hasn't plateaued, it's declined. And that surprises me. And as I said, I don't know whether it's a blip, it could just be the way things are going, but it also could be a sign of what Paul Graham has said, you know, Microsoft is dead because they're no longer dangerous. Who knows? I don't know.
I think it's a great point in terms of what developers, alpha geeks or whatever they choose to work on, has serious repercussions for everything else. So even if Ruby on Rails is a tiny blip in the larger scale and picture of things compared to 6 million Java developers and how many million Microsoft developers, it matters who. It's not just a conversation about the numbers. And I think we're seeing the same thing with Ruby on Rails as we, in some sense, were seeing with Agile and with XP. People leave companies to work in more passionate environments. And if they were forced to work in waterfall development processes and practices, they would leave that company to go chase an XP shop or an Agile environment. And I'm seeing the same kind of thing. A lot of people come up to me and say, I quit my job because of Java. I quit my job because of .NET. I simply did not want to work in an environment where we use those tools anymore. I'm not passionate about those tools, so I chose to take a minor position somewhere else doing Ruby on Rails. I chose to go freelance doing Ruby on Rails, and I'm much happier now.
And the interesting thing is, this is not because Microsoft is short of interesting technologies. I mean, you look at what's going on with Link, really interesting stuff. Our main guy who looks at a lot of Microsoft stuff, Mike Tu, who's one of the guys who wrote NUnit, he's very keen on the workflow stuff in Windows. He says this is really good technology. But it's almost as if there's some weird distortion field floating around Microsoft, and the interesting technologies aren't getting out there and engaging people. Oh, it's yet another add-on to Visual Studio and some designer, and there's no attempt to really make that impact and engagement. And as I said, I think the reaction to Ruby is going to be an interesting sign of that, because there's an opportunity there to really say, okay, we can engage.
I've always felt a little strange about Microsoft in its size. It's not one company of 30,000 people. It's about 3,000 10-person companies, and they're competing against each other. You know, I mean, who knows how many different implementations died internally before one, you know, made it out. There seems to be this sense that, and I've always felt that they should put more wood behind the arrowhead. I had lunch with Ray Ozzie, the chief architect of Microsoft, while I was at Mix, and I wanted to understand kind of the multi-year plan. And it was much more relaxed than I had expected. He was very developer-focused. We're going to give them great tools, and then they will make the next big thing. But I kind of felt like I was meeting the Pope, and I wanted some dogma laid down. I wanted some super passionate expression of, just a declaration. You, David, are certainly not in any way devoid of opinions, and you have expressed them. Some fly, some don't. But you're not afraid of saying it ought to be like this. I think people like that, don't they?
I think they do, and I think that's one of the reasons Microsoft is currently looked upon with great suspicion right now. They're jumping in all directions, it seems. Oh, you can choose whatever language you want. We don't have any opinions on that. We spend so much time on the whole SOAP-WS Death Star approach, and now this REST stuff looks like it's gaining traction, so let's do something with that too. It seems like there's no direction. It seems like there's no focus. And even worse than that, it seems like there's great infighting, that we can get this spasm over the Linux patents. I'm pretty sure that Ray Ossie was really shaking his head when that press release went out, and like, how much of my good work just went undone.
I have no doubt he did not okay that press release.
Exactly, and that's just one of those reasons that a lot of people don't trust Microsoft. They have so many hats. They're a hydra in that sense. So even though one guy might be smiling, another guy from within the same company is trying to bite your head off.
Well, and as a Microsoft enthusiast, and, you know, I'm a Microsoft guy until I declare that I'm not. You know, they've happily paid my mortgage, you know, indirectly for the last many years. I like the people. I have yet to meet an individual at Microsoft who I consider to be evil. I've yet to meet one I even would consider to be kind of creepy or not trustworthy. They're just all very pleasant on an individual or small team basis. You know, John Lamb, the guy who's working on the DLR with Jim Huguenin, two great guys. I hope that they are heard at the higher levels. I hope that someone up at the top says, this could be something. There, you know, we could be a member of the Rails community and have a great implementation of Ruby on .NET. But I don't know. Is it Ray Ossie? Is it Bill's? Not Bill's busy.
I know. And I think that the thing is that the notion of evil is a weird term, because I don't believe that in any of this there are truly evil people. But I do believe there are malicious deeds. And I do believe that the actions speak much louder than words, in the sense of a person can very much be a pleasant person to be around, and you can like that person, and still his actions can be appalling. And I think that that's really what they need to be judged on. They're not being judged on how nice people there are. We're not saying that we dislike any of them personally. We're saying that as a company, they've done some deeds as recently as last week that we not only don't agree with, but find appalling and puts a really bad spin on everybody else. They are, when it comes down to it, one company. And even though there are good forces, it can very, very quickly become undone. And every time a deed like the Linux spasm over patents goes up, it erases all of that goodwill they build up. So it seems very much like they start building up good stuff, and then they take it away. So it's very fluctuating right now. And I think they need just a longer period of time where they're just not doing bad deeds. We can't trust them for 3 months at a time. They've had such a long history to infect us and give us a certain perception of the company that they need a long time to redeem that.
Well, I'm certainly not I don't want to bash Microsoft, and I don't want to speak too hyperbolically about Microsoft, but I do feel like, to what you're saying, some leadership at the top levels and some declarations of, like, even then the Google side of don't be evil. You know, early on, they were very out there. Larry and Sergey were like, you know, this is how things are going to go. And even Google's starting to get that fragmented sense. You know, there's all these different labs. Everyone's working on something in their spare time. You can't really cover up internal fragmentation with a little toolbar at the top of the page with the, and here are the 15 other things that you could search. And except for Frugal, that was too useful. We can't give you that. You know, can you have a company that big that has one face, one voice of goodness, of developer empowerment? I mean, could Ray turn this around by making some declarations, by shutting some projects down, by putting some emphasis on others, and And just as the U.S. is attempting to do that, as we reach out to other countries, I mean, as you're speaking, both of you, Martin and David, to, I'm seeing these parallels as we are trying to say, no, we're really good. We really are. We're trying to tell the world we have good things.
And I think that's a great parallel. Again, it doesn't help to tell somebody you're good. You have to be good. You have to act good. You judge people on their actions, not on their words. And that's what we're doing with Microsoft in a large sense. So I think they have a very ingrained culture that came from a period of time of when they had great success in the 90s and so on, where a certain strategy worked, where you could cut off the air supply, and that was a good business tactic that made you billions of dollars. So in some sense, why wouldn't you? And taking that out again is very, very hard. And it's even harder when you have 40,000 people, some of them have worked there for 15 years. That just doesn't happen overnight.
Well, it is comforting to me to see people like John and Jim care about the language. And I know that as a Microsoft developer, I would like to be able to do some Rails. And I'd like to be able to host it on IIS and run it in a data center that runs SQL Server 2005. But until then, I am enjoying my time here at the Rails conference. And I appreciate both of you guys offering the time to sit down and chat with me. Is there anything that you'd like to add in closing, sir?
Thanks for taking time to talk to us. It's always fun to talk to somebody who don't necessarily have the same religion as yourself, in the sense that this is a meeting of the faithful.
It's a cultural exchange here, yes.
Exactly.
And I enjoyed it too. It's always nice to share a chair with David, because I can be quiet and reasonable. And it's just like when I was sharing a podium with Kent. It's great to be the straight man.
Well, thank you so much for letting this .NET Bedouin come into your camp here. And that's another episode of Hansel Minutes. We'll see you next week.